Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 447, it is the preview of the November 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that Retinal Physician can be found online and in print. The website is retinalphysician.com. Joined by my colleagues, Drs. Avni Fun and Sarwar Zahid for this episode, we talk about three semi-unrelated topics, but first is on Stargardt's disease, some of the ongoing trials, and what we expect for the future for IRD. Then we talk about choroidal nevi, melanoma, and referral patterns, and end with a discussion of social media for physicians and ophthalmologists. Remember that CME credits are available for prior episodes. You can find that link in the episode description. And a list of relevant financial disclosures are always present in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the November 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. As always, you can find Retinal Physician online and in print at retinalphysician.com. Joining me for this episode, two of my colleagues from around the country, Drs. Avni Finn and Sarwar Zahid. Avni, first in Nashville, Tennessee. Avni, welcome.
Thanks, Jay.
And Sarwar joining us from New York. Sarwar, welcome back.
Great to be back, Jay. Thank you.
Okay, let's jump right in. So again, the goal of this is not a journal club. These are articles written by some of our colleagues. Just interesting things to discuss. I want to start with this article on choroidal nevus follow-up, because this was written by a team out of Mayo Clinic, Namita Saraf, Laura Dalvin, and Sophie Bakri is the chair there. And again, to summarize kind of the big take-home points, they talk about why is this important, right? So if you're a trainee listening, you know, the reason people are concerned about choroidal nevus is they want to make sure it's not a melanoma or something that could be clinically significant, whereas most nevi are not clinically significant. The first section just talks about some of the things that are differences between them. It was interesting to sort of see some of the imaging. And again, I think there's like these classic acronyms that we learn, the SHIELDS, for example, popularized TFSOM or define small ocular melanoma using helpful hints here. It's doing imaging. Regardless, it's some of the classic things, you know, thickness greater than 2 millimeters, subretinal fluid, symptoms, orange pigment, the acoustic hollowness, diameter, absence of halo, you know, absence of again, that hyporeflectivity on B scan. These are all things that I think we learned during residency that give us risk factors. And, you know, one of the other things, again, is race. Although, again, I think when you get one patient in front of you, that becomes less of a significant issue. You know, but one of the things we'll talk about is follow-up, because we get into this at the end, is how do you follow these patients? What's the best way to follow them, and who should follow them? And obviously a melanoma is going to get treated and a nevus is not going to get treated. And that's why it's such a big question who to follow. And Avni, I'll start with you. You know, one of the questions that comes up, and I'm sure it varies place to place, is who does the follow-up for a nevus if it is deemed medium to high risk, right? The easy answer is if it's medium to high risk, get it to an ocular oncologist. But that varies depending on your availability. I'll give you an example here at LA County. We don't have any full-time ocular oncologists. The only one who does ocular oncology is Dr. Jesse Berry, who's full-time at USC and spends a little bit of time taking care of county patients. And, you know, it's just not reasonable, or it's kind of a microcosm of a bigger problem. It's not actually actionable to have her see every single patient who is potentially has a melanoma. So you need to figure out A, how to screen and triage the patients, and B, how to sort of follow them in a way that can lead to appropriate referrals, especially when you have limited resources, limited slots to see different providers, kind of going up that scale from optometry, ophthalmology, retina, and then finally ocular oncology. So first of all, your thoughts on like, how should these patients be followed? Who should see them? And again, I think we all know about the obvious ones. There's things that are obvious nevi that have drusen, that are pigmented, that look classic. They don't generally get referred. And then we have the actual lesions that we're concerned about, even metastatic disease, they get referred. But it's the in-between ones I'm curious about. Like your thoughts, again, give practice in two different practice environments now on the West Coast and now back at Vanderbilt. What are your thoughts on sort of who should see these patients and how you refer?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Both in private practice and actually now in an academic environment, I tend to follow a lot of these patients, and that's mostly because of access to care. In private practice, we were often referred a lot of these patients anytime they were concerning to either a general ophthalmologist or an optometrist. And I would really only refer these patients if I were concerned that they were melanoma. To our ocular oncologist who practiced in the area. And now at Vanderbilt, we do have an ocular oncologist, but I do go to a lot of satellite locations all over Middle Tennessee, and we go all the way out to Kentucky. And so for those patients, it's not reasonable to have them see an ocular oncologist. And like you said, that's one person, and their clinic can get overwhelmed with patients. And so for many of the patients that you are following, even if they're, semi-concerning lesions need to be followed every 3 to 6 months, you can easily, I feel like, do that yourself. I tend to follow them with imaging and ultrasound. And I think it's more important for the patients to have consistent follow-up than to have follow-up with an ocular oncologist when you are comfortable following them. So I think it's important as a retina specialist for us to gain, and I say this to our fellows all the time, to gain experience with these concerning lesions, seeing what's concerning, what's not concerning, what's kind of in the middle, and how to follow them, because no matter almost what practice you're in, you will see these lesions, you will need to follow them, and you should be comfortable with that.
Great points. And Sarah, I'll get your thoughts too on what imaging you get, right? Because I think this is like, I think it's so funny. It's almost like, and we joke with Akshay when he comes on, but if you ask a uveitis person, right, they're always going to tell you to get a wide field FA and maybe an ICG. And if you ask an ocular oncologist how you should be following a nevus, and this is not pointing fun at them, this is how they would follow it. They get maximum imaging, right? They would want OCT, autofluorescence, fundus photography, B scan. All of these battery of tests, because and it's real, because they get added information from each one. Like we've talked about a lot in this program, everything we're dealing in medicine is really about probabilities. We don't have 100% certainty. Now, certain things, it's like 99.99999%. Like you're pretty sure you know what it is. But the reason you want to stack the tests is because there are case reports, there are weird things that happen. There may be something that meets certain criteria to not be high risk, and it still ends up being malignant, which is why you get the other tests. And it reflects their greater degree of understanding an ocular oncologist would have in terms of following a lesion than you, me, or Avni, right? That being said, realistically, most either providers who are going to be following these patients may not have access to all those tests, or access to, for example, someone in their imaging department at a certain office who's able to capture a mid-periphery OCT of a lesion, or to get a reasonable B scan with the equipment that's available. So, like, my thought process, and I'm curious what you said, is like generally it's like get a photo. If you can get an OCT through it, awesome, and just sort of follow it that way. I don't know if you feel anything different, right? Because it's always interesting to see that difference in a super specialist, subspecialist versus a comprehensive person, what they get in terms of their imaging. But like, I'm sure now you're in solo practice, you may keep that choroidal nevus patient because they've been referred to you for a reason. You may follow them for some time. And then what do you tell the patient, right? So like what I usually just tell the patient, like, look, it's probably never going to be a problem. It's like a lesion on your skin, but you can't check it yourself, which is why you come in. But I'm curious if you say anything else to them, because obviously patients are worried when they get to you because someone has told them, hey, you have this thing in your eye. And maybe that person who referred them said the dreaded C word, and the patient's freaking out a little bit.
Great points. I also like to follow these patients myself. With regards to imaging, I try to get everything. I mean, I have the benefit of not being as busy as I hope to be in about, 12 to 18 months, but I try to get everything. I mean, like, as you mentioned, the OCT, the wide field optos, I try to get one from the referring doctor. If the patient tells me that they've had this done before, having the autofluorescence is helpful because it really picks up the lipofuscin pigment, especially if there's suspicion for orange pigment. I love doing the OCT over the along the arcades because there's some slightly thickened nevi over the arcades. And no matter how good of an ultrasound you have, it's hard to assess the thickness, and you can get a nice assessment of thickness on, especially if you have a extended depth of focus Not, oh my God, I'm thinking of IOLs, not extended depth of field. It's an EDI OT, OTT. Oh my God, what's happening
So,
here?
what's your practice branching into? I just want to know what medium you're going through. What are you listening
Oh man,
to?
there goes my referral patterns, you know. But I love getting the EDI OCT. And I think what you mentioned about patient counseling is really important, because I think it's really important to have these reassuring discussions to reassure our patients, like, look, this is something that we just need to watch and follow. I try to get all those little bits and pieces of imaging every single time, because sometimes, you know, even with the nevus, even with like a 1.5 millimeter nevus, that compress, you know, similar to any lesion in the choroid, you can get a little compression and a little pocket of subretinal fluid. That's not necessarily alarming subretinal fluid, but it's something that we can't necessarily pick up on B scan. Another thing I think is really helpful for all of us is we're not necessarily having life or death conversations. Whenever I mean, I'm lucky to have a few ocular oncologists readily available in the city. And I get patients, and I'm like, okay, something has changed, or this looks kind of weird. I don't know what this is. It has enough concerning findings that I want to get you to an ocular oncologist. That patient is going to want to talk to you at that point. And I think we should all at least get into the habit of saying, like, look, I'm concerned for this. I think this may be a melanoma, but, you know, instead of demoralizing the patient, something we don't practice, right? Like, talk a little bit about, like, you know, there are some great tools available. And remember, and a lot of times patients may get, you know, they may get emotional, they may, you know, like start crying. We're not always having these conversations. So I think getting that, you know, doing that level of doctoring is something, you know, we don't always practice. But it's good to have something in your back pocket just to be like, yeah, there's some great treatments available. We're still in control. We're getting you to this specialist within the next couple of days. So we're doing everything we can. So that's something I encourage everyone to sort of keep in their back pocket.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, let's comment on that before we move on. Like, I think that we aren't used to that conversation in Star Wars, as most of the things we deal with, we're in the business of lowering expectations, right? You're taught in fellowship, hey, someone's an RD, you don't want to depress them, but you need to sort of give them realistic expectations, lower expectations a little bit, because people have a view of eye surgery that involves and EDOF, IOLs, and LALs and premium IOLs, especially if they're pseudophakic, and you've got to give them a whole different sort of presentation as the retina specialist, right? Whether you're doing a sutured lens, an ERM, an RD, like your expectation level is not going to be the same as if they've had previous encounters with eye surgeons. But on the other hand, like the communication has to be good within the team. And I'll give a great example from recently. You know, we work in a hospital, so occasionally we'll get referrals where patients have been sort of seen by other specialties and then referred. And we had a patient recently. It was a nice woman who, again, the resident presents to me that she's got a choroidal lesion and there's concern, and they've been working this patient up for possible systemic disease. And you know, you look at the picture and immediately are like, look, that is very suspicious for a metastatic lesion. And you know, her lung is filled with these things, and she's got other parts of her body with many of these lesions. And so, you know, my first question is like, how much does this person know? Like, they're getting this workup, right? Has anyone actually had the conversation with them? And it turned out that no one had really talked to her about this. They just sort of been like, oh, we'll get this test and this. And I can get it because you don't want to overcall something, but there's sort of the in between, right? And my point as a retina specialist is if you see something that's potentially really bad, you obviously don't want to depress the patient to Star Wars' point, but you need to sort of either lead them or at least talk to your specialist before they see them so they don't get something like, oh my God, like, what are you talking about? Dr. So-and-so, Dr. Sridhar didn't say anything about this being blah, blah. He just said, I needed to see you and didn't explain why. So it's like that fine art of that in between, like Sarah was saying, of like, you have to break it sort of in a stepwise fashion, even if you think it's not great news. It's not that you go in there and be like, well, you've got stage four cancer and the survival rate is 15% and good luck to you and you walk out of the room. But between that and saying, hey, I'm not going to tell you anything about what we're doing. Go see this other doctor and take these tests. Yeah, I think it's an interesting balance because you also need to set up your super specialist or specialist for success when they have that conversation. I think we've all experienced that with RDs, for example, where patients are referred. The great referral doctors have told them they have a problem that may need surgery. The patients who haven't heard that conversation, that's a really hard thing to wrap their head around when they show up and be like, wait, I need surgery? And you're like, yeah, obviously, like that's why you're here.
Yeah, I think those are really great points. And the other thing I would emphasize is the history taking in these patients is also really important, right? We do take very kind of focused histories on a lot of our patients, you know, who might come in with diabetic retinopathy, and we ask about some systemic diseases. But this is one of those times that You do want to ask about a family history. You do want to ask about cancer history, and even sometimes other autoimmune diseases that can show up with choroidal lesions. So I think in addition to kind of the importance of counseling once you've found something, is that making sure you've documented their personal history as well, as you're following these patients, because it can heighten or, potentially decrease your concern for whatever it is that you're following.
Beautiful. We got this next article, Brittany Scrubs and Joseph Gia Coloni from Mayo put this together. It's a Mayo heavy episode. Good for Mayo. On Stargardt disease and future treatment horizons. And again, I think the first part of this is things that as a retina specialist or a retina trainee, Stargardt's obviously the most common macular dystrophy. ABCA4 is that buzzword for your board exams or OCAPS, buildup of A2E and which is a component of lipofuscin. And obviously there's a tremendous sort of phenotypic and genotypic variation in Stargardt. It doesn't have to be a certain variant ABCA4, and that will affect when it presents. Classic Stargardt's in childhood or adolescence, but some patients don't get this till later in life. And that's obviously a huge difference for these patients. If you know what the prognosis is and what age they get it, that will alter what they can expect in terms of what they're going to predict for their own futures and prepare for their lives. And then the big thing, what we want to hear about is genetic testing, right? So genetic testing has gone through these waxing and waning sort of availabilities, right? And we can talk a little bit about that, the genetic panels that have been available but no longer are available, the genetic panels that are available, and how you get your patient's genetic testing. And again, there's no FDA-approved cure. The vitamin A thing is very interesting, and this is very different than RP. In Stargardt's, the idea is to avoid excessive vitamin A. And there's actually decent evidence for this versus an RP. The vitamin A supplementation, we can save that for another episode, is very a little bit controversial depending on who you talk to and what paper you look at. But then it's the emergent treatments, and that's really the end of this, right? There are some observational studies, but most patients don't want to be in an observational study, and there are some studies looking at things such as oral metformin or other pharmacologic things in trial. For example, Alkeus ALK-001, which is a form of vitamin A, is being explored. And then there's Belite Bio with tinlarebant, RBP4 antagonist in phase three trials. And then, IZERVAY, there was a little bit famous. We can talk a little bit about that. There is a phase 2b trial for IZERVAY for Stargardt, which I wasn't aware of before I read this. So I learned something reading this article. But again, one of the only, I think the only really proven or reported episode of vasculitis or IOI with IZERVAY was a Stargardt's patient, actually, which was given off-label. And then stem cell and gene therapy ending there. And gene therapy is obviously the most exciting. Ocugen, for example, has a drug, and there's a bunch of different companies that are mentioned here in early phase trials. So, Sarah, I'll start with you. I mean, just in terms of, we can talk about management and counseling, and but what are you doing for genetic testing, right? So, like, we went through having, Spark obviously was very promotional of having genetic testing, but not all these genetic tests are as available as they once were. This is something we've talked about in different chat threads and group threads, retina specialists. If you have a patient that needs genetic testing, let's say someone's listening, they're not sure how to get their patient genetic testing, what do you do in terms of getting them affordable or free genetic testing?
So this is I love talking about this because like my gateway into retina was IRDs. So I did a lot of ABCA4 studies and it's like crazy the genotypic phenotypic variability. So I don't do a ton of IRD treatment at this point, but it was crazy like people when these tests became available, all of a sudden there's like a bunch of retina specialists and like people spitting all over and like all these tubes going out so people can get genetic testing. So I in my practice, I actually use Blueprint genetic testing, and their reports are excellent. And I think the information that's provided in these reports are really great. But an important thing to think about in like what I try to do with any sort of positive result I still try, especially when there's a high suspicion of retinal dystrophy. I'm not talking about like, oh, could this be an inflammatory condition? Let's test for this. Let's get a QuantiFERON and an RPR FTA just to make sure. I'm talking about this is something that someone that has progressive vision loss. The tough thing is, and what I think makes IRD so complex, is a lot of people will have a pathogenic mutation in, for example, ABCA4, or and a variant of unspecified significance in one of the other alleles. And that becomes complicated because you don't know if they if it's a mutation that's acting in cis or trans, and that actually makes a difference because that may affect the disease prognosis. Anyone with a positive result, I try to get those patients to an IRD specialist, and I think everybody should have a phone number or contact for their local IRD specialist. And I know this is a little bit harder in more rural areas, but it's helpful because remember, if you want to provide proper IRD care, there's a genetic counseling component that needs to happen. There's a an ERG component that needs to happen. We can talk about, and people did debate what is the significance of a full field ERG because it can be so heterogeneous and it can vary so dramatically from an early to a late stage of disease. But an IRD clinic will have microperimetry, will have Goldman visual fields, which has been shown to be slightly more accurate in some of these patients, especially as the field becomes more narrow. And most importantly, genetic testing. And as retina specialist, I mean, I'm, like, while I find this stuff very interesting, I haven't necessarily kept up to date. That's why I love publications like Retinal Physician, because it helps me sort of refresh on what exactly is going on. And this is a very active field. So I think, I tell patients, like, look, I'm a retina specialist, but if you go to these IRD specialists, they may know that, oh, this is a good candidate for this trial. Oh, actually, for this specific variant of unknown significance, you shouldn't take this vitamin A supplementation. So that's why I think it's really important to get these patients to that level.
Yeah, I was just going to build on something, Sarwar, that you said. I think historically these patients were followed by retina specialists in the community, and I do think it's really important now to refer these patients to an inherited retinal degenerations expert as well as a geneticist, because we've seen several times that patients will say, yes, I've had genetic testing, but it might not be a complete panel of genetic testing, and then a potentially new mutation or new genetic test shows up abnormal. We're lucky, obviously, to have an IRD clinic here, but one that's paired with a geneticist. And I think that genetic counseling component of this is so important, especially as we are now in the era of having these potential treatments for these patients, and to identify new mutations and potentially disease-specific mutations that then we can enroll these patients in trials or even treatment in the future.
And I'm going to make a comment that's both pragmatic, hopeful, and cynical, if that's possible. Going back 15 years ago or 20 years ago, there was less interest in both people going into IRD as a subspecialty and in practices and institutions hiring IRD specialists, unless, again, it was an academic with NIH funding, things like that. And it makes sense, right? You as an individual, you're less attracted to fields where you can't fix a problem. And as a practice, from a functional perspective, there's no money there, and these patients don't generate any income. Then why would you be incentivized to go after an IRD specialist? So, what's happened over the last probably 10 years is, again, Luxturna comes out, huge breakthrough. So there's an interesting sort of duality that there's more and more students who are now fellows or going out in practice who were inspired by that. And like you saw where they got IRD inspired, but maybe unlike you, they're a little bit younger and they were there when they actually, maybe they saw a Luxturna patient when they were operating. Not that you're old, but we're not young anymore. We're not the YOs. And so like, I do think I see more and more fellow applicants or residency applicants who are like, oh, I'm really interested in IRDs and I want to pursue that as a career. It makes sense. Just like more and more people are attracted to glaucoma as they sort of see, okay, there may be treatment options beyond just drops. At the same time, there are practices now really pushing for when I talk to fellows, they're like, oh, I'll hire you if you do IRD. And I think this is where we both have to have that joint mutual responsibility you both were talking about. It's not simply that you hire an IRD specialist and now you can hold all your genetic diseases in your practice. So now when, trial company A or B comes to you knocking at your door, you can receive their clinical trial funding, and that's a source of revenue and income, justifying hiring an IRD specialist. You have to set up your IRD person for success. You need to have options for genetic counseling. You should have a coordinator to help them. No different than if you're hiring a pediatric retina specialist, an ocular oncologist, or any other sort of sub super specialized retina person, like we were just talking about. And this is sort of the PSA, right? Because I think I hear stories of practices now being like telling a fellow, oh, go do 6 months of IRD and come back. And fellows like, I'm interested in that. But then the next question should be, okay, are you going to set me up where I can actually can do this? Or is this simply sort of a financial play because you think that the money is there? And I would say that from a similar standpoint, Luxturna was reasonably successful, right? Spark, obviously from a scientific perspective and advancing the field, huge breakthrough, awesome for the field. At the same time, they had a limited sort of market share because of the patients they were looking at. The cost of the drug and the number of institutions that could supply the drug. There's a lot more interest in Stargardt because it's a lot more common than RPE65 mutations for LCA or RP. But again, you have to think how many drugs are there going to be available for a given mutation? Ideally, it would just be one or two. And then what is the price point for those drugs, right? Are these going to be $850,000 for both eyes? Which again, that's a child and that's their life and that's vision. I think it's totally worth it. I'm not arguing at the price or the cost of doing business to develop one of these drugs. But my point is, these companies can simultaneously be incentivized to advance the field. And they also are incentivized because they view it as something that can make a significant amount of capital back for their investors and for their own company. Or they're looking to sell their company. So again, this is sort of just, I mean, I know we're all sort of aware of this, but just sort of the general PSA to like, we got to take all these things with a grain of salt. We got to interpret it properly. We got to understand that, yeah, it could be something that's really altruistic, but it also has a financial component to it. And that's important when you're interpreting what's being said on the podium. How significant are the results? What tests are you using? We talked in a previous episode, like, what are our outcomes for clinical trials? One of the biggest conflicts of interest is the person designing the trial, besides wanting to be scientifically accurate so they're not poked holes in later, they're incentivized to make sure that they hit their primary endpoint. So they're kind of trying to go through that very fine needle point of, okay, I designed something that's scientifically defensible, but I also really want this to show something. So again, I don't know enough about these trials to say one trial is better than the other. That's why, as you said, Sarwar, it's better to ask an IRD specialist which trials may be better for a certain patient. But I'm saying as we interpret this and as we sort of assessing this for our patients, we have to be aware that when there's significant amounts of money involved, that there are going to be some trials that are better designed than others. And then just because something is really successful in phase one, phase two, and we hear all about it, doesn't mean that it's going to end up in phase two or three. We might just be hearing a lot about it because they want to cash out at phase one and two and sell that to a bigger company or sell it to investors, or they're just trying to raise sort of the stock price of a stock before selling it. And I know that's a very cynical way to end that sort of long PSA, but that is something we all have to be aware of because that's stuff I was not aware of in training or in the first couple of years that I've learned more and more over time. But I'll open it up. Sarwar, you had a comment about IRD evaluation and also the workup.
Oh, I just think as a small practice, it just takes a really long time to do these. I mean, it takes a long time to draw out a family tree, to get a thorough history of the family. ERGs take a long time, because you got to dark adapt the patients. Microperimetry takes a lot of extra training. So just from a as a small practice, I think, it's a hard thing for a small practice to justify, because it's each patient takes such a long period of time. And but the question is, like as a healthcare system, I think, these patients are really important because, if we're trying to like preserve their vision, these are, often young patients who have long lives ahead of them. We need to set them up for success so they can continue to live a fulfilling life and contribute to society in the way that they want to.
Abdi, your comments. You wanted, I think, some thoughts on what does it look like, right? Where are we going to be doing these treatments anyway, beyond trials?
Yeah, I think thinking about like what the future of IRD is very interesting because it sort of depends on what treatment modalities win out in the end and what has the most success. But if you think about potentially gene therapy for these patients where we identify a genetic mutation and have a therapy, thinking about that multidisciplinary workup and counseling that's needed for these patients. And then potentially you have a one-time treatment. Perhaps it's most pragmatic and economical to then set up, centers of excellence or centers of therapy across the country that can be accessed, and then patients can be followed by retina specialists closer to home. And I think that that's one potential way of the future to take care of these patients, except especially when you think about, the high cost of the drug, keeping that drug in some facility, and someone having to just store it. Like that cost alone is a lot for a practice,
Yeah.
and may not make economic sense.
Well, which begs the question, to my point is, are you really interested in doing the drugs once they come to market, or are you just interested in doing the trials because it makes more economical sense? And that we will find out more about. But this has nothing to do, these articles have nothing to do with one another, which I think is great because it leads to three very different types of discussion. But this last article is by Rehan Hussein. It's about leveraging social media to enhance a career. There's nothing more meta than talking about an article about social media on a podcast in 2024, but let's do it. Rehan, this is a really, really well-written article. I would invite anybody who's interested in doing social media or using social media as a retina specialist to read this. Rehan's done a lot for both his own practice, but for the Vit-Buckle Society in terms of running Instagram accounts, and he talks about kind of the different platforms, right? So I think the first thing is, what's the difference if you've been living under a rock, or you don't know what TikTok is, right? So you have different platforms: Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter slash X, or TikTok. Like, what are the goals and who uses those? Then sort of the next one is, what do you do? Like, what are the things that people like to read about? And it's honestly, it's dealer's choice. You could talk about many different things on social media related to your personal life, professional life, or just general things that would relate to the field of retina. And then how do you do things for your practice, like paid advertising? Do you work with influencers? How do you get patients? How do you interact with patients? How do you get your staff to view social media in a good manner? How do you integrate with your website if you do have a practice? I mean, this is a very variable avenue depending on what your goals are, where you work. Like, are you trying to get people to come to your practice, or are you just doing this because you enjoy it? I'm curious what your thoughts are on social media and retina. Like, obviously, it can be enjoyable. Social media, like anything, can be enjoyable. It can also be exhausting. What do you tell your trainees, right? Are any of your trainees, have you seen really into this? Do a lot of them sort of stay away from it? Like, where are the trends going as someone who works with residents and fellows in terms of, do they want to use social media for professional goals, personal goals? Do they not see the differentiation?
I think we have all sorts of trainees. I think that the trainees potentially like looking at programs. I've seen more and more residency programs have social media accounts to let other applicants or other medical students kind of know about the program. I think it's also used within residency programs to create community within the residency itself. And it's kind of a growing area for residency programs. I haven't seen as much use among fellows or fellowship programs. And I think that most residents and fellows are more interested in keeping their professional career, professional lives on social media separate from their personal lives on social media. And so the people that I know that have social media accounts almost have like two separate accounts, or may use, like Rehan talked about all of the different social media platforms. They may kind of engage in LinkedIn for professional activities, but then on Instagram or Facebook for more personal activities. So I haven't seen it growing in retina, I think, as much as other fields like oculoplastics, for example. It seems like every single oculoplastics person I know has a social media account, and it's almost like a part of their practice is showing the work they do on
Yeah.
social media. I don't see it growing that much in retina, as I do, just societies and training programs having an account to kind of show what's going on within them.
Yeah, that's true. And oculoplastics is obviously very, very different, right? Cash pay patients, patients seeking out doctors. Maybe patients are seeking out doctors more and more in every field, but retina, again, dependent on insurance, practice patterns, referrals, is going to be a little more insulated. I mean, that being said, so are Avni's point. There's a huge retina community that grows and grows and grows. And I think one of the aerospaces you see a lot of it is sort of interaction with industry, especially LinkedIn. You look at some of the interactions, and that's an interesting sort of boundary and line to think about, right? Because there aren't isn't that much regulation of sort of what happens in that space. We have so much compliance, right, when it comes to, hey, if you go to this lunch and you ate a sandwich, to quote someone recently who said this, you got to report it to the government and say that you ate a sandwich because of Sunshine Act reporting. No, you can take guess as to who I'm quoting as I say that. But if you quote a rep online and you post, or you post something that's both promoting yourself and promoting a product and also promoting a company, there's not the same regulation. And maybe you don't get paid for it, but you are sort of someone who works with this company a lot, or you get research funding, or and honestly, I'm not critical of it because I do some of this, and it depends how much do you believe in it, right? That's the sincerity part, which is very hard to know. But I would say be cautious with for anyone who's getting this space. People in life don't often tell you what they really think about what you're doing. Very few people in your circle will be honest with you, and that's true for everything. And so you could be doing things and thinking you're doing a great job, and then meanwhile, people who are your colleagues are behind your back being like, this is super insincere. Why would they do it this way? Just any advice or PSAs on how you sort of bridge that gap, or again, that fine line between, hey, I'm producing things that's helpful to my career, helpful to my patients, or yeah, I work with this company a lot, but also doesn't come across as insincere and sort of the joke, well, I'm the first retina specialist in the Tri-County area who practices out of an office with four lanes to inject this drug in X patient. And I'm humbled and I'm honored and I'm privileged and so thankful we're in such a great age of retina therapeutics. And thank you to our amazing patients and thank you to this company. Like, I mean, I'm joking, but these are the sort of things we see. And there's different levels to it, right? So, I mean, what are your thoughts and sort of what do you take from it in terms of, what advice would you give a person going to practice who's like, hey, I want to make my name. I want to get invited to ad boards. I want to be out there and I like using social media. How do you sort of toe that line?
I love that you brought up the, being the first person, within the 2 block radius to do like the latest Medicaid pre-filled medication. Because honestly, like stuff like that is annoying to me because I find it very self-promotion, and I think that the point is like an important point is it's very easy to appear to your colleagues as like, oh, I'm just promoting myself. Or I'm promoting my practice rather than like true content that adds value. I think and I've started to work with some industry partners, and I think what I at least try to do, and I think it's important for young trainees, starting young attending, starting to work with industry. When you see a speaker, giving a talk or at an ad board, you can sort of, like when you ask them questions, sometimes you can tell, I say, oh, what do you think of this medication? And then they're like, yeah, how many have you done? Oh, yeah, I've done two of these in the last 4 years. I'm like, okay, that's not really helpful, right? Because then it's sort of more of, it's not as honest, I mean, I think it's great to work with companies who create products. We're really lucky to have these amazing companies who create products to help us take care of our patients. If you believe in a product, if you believe in certain medications, and more importantly, based on your experience, you can teach other people, like, oh, in my patient population, for example, I use a lot of steroid. So when I talk to my colleagues, I say, you know what? I'd like to do this because in my patient population, it's really poorly controlled. So I like that controlled steroid. So, I mean, I've been told that that's something that's valuable. So I think work with companies that you believe in. The other thing is, on social media, Rehan makes some amazing points. I think it's important to identify what your goal is. Is your goal to, build your brand, your individual brand, and who is that brand for? Number one, your patients. Number two, your colleagues and how your colleagues perceive you. Number three, how industry perceives you, especially if you want to have industry relationships. Especially if you start a, and the thing is, like when I actually do a decent amount of social media stuff. I have like eight different social media accounts because I have this DJ account, like stand-up comedy, like my practice, my private account.
So let me ask you a
So it can,
question, not to interrupt, but why do you keep them separate, right? This is an interesting question, right? Because that's always a question, is why separate all of them?
So that's a great question. For me, keeping it separate is because I feel like each of them have separate brands. Like for example, I have my at DJ Skeesis on Instagram. So, I don't want to post my DJ stuff on my practice account. Or when I have some sort of event, like for example, I did a CE talk last week and I posted that on my my practice account. So I think there's other reasons. I mean, I think Avni, you mentioned this. Some people have a private account and some people have their personal account. Sometimes you want to keep those separate because if you have like certain political leanings, or if you feel very strongly about something, or we have an election coming up, you want to comment on that. Unfortunately, we live in kind of a divisive society, and that makes it really tough because no matter how, nice we are to each other, like there are people who will judge us differently based on our political values, or our political views. So that's one reason that I know a lot of people keep it separately. I think the most important thing is to try to stay true. Don't appear like you're just posting content just for the sake of posting content. And it is important to promote your own brand. It is important to promote yourself. But if it's just for the sake of pure self-promotion, your colleagues can see through that. And it's less, I think it adds less value.
Yeah, I mean, any comments on that point? I think there's some great points about my point I make when people ask me about it is I'm just like, do it if you enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, you don't need to force yourself to do it. Why would you do that? Life is short. And I get students sometimes who are like, well, I have to do it, right? I see other students doing it and they're building their careers and their connections that way. I see people going to practice. Well, I need to do this because I need to keep up, or it's sort of like the keeping up with the Joneses. And I'm just like, the thing people are really successful with it must enjoy it beyond just getting the likes, right? They're actually doing something that makes them happy, and no judgment of that. It makes them happy. Let them do it. I don't really give much advice beyond that, besides just don't get yourself in trouble. Don't violate HIPAA. Don't say something that, as Star Wars says, pisses off the wrong person. Be careful what patients have access to, and train your staff the same way because they need to be careful and they're under your liability, especially if you own your own practice. Do you have any other advice you give people when they ask you about social media?
No, I really agree with that point about do it if you enjoy it, because it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of consistency. And there are so many other things that we can devote our time to, at work and at home. And so I think that you really have to put your time into it if it is something you enjoy and you get something out of. And perhaps you pick one social media platform to really dedicate your time to if you want to be on social media. But I think it's impossible for all of us to be, unless your thing is social media, for example, like Rayhan, to be really successful on multiple different mediums and platforms. And so I would say if you want to be involved on social media, pick one platform, be consistent and strong on that one platform. And then if you feel like it's something that's helping you and it's rewarding to you, personally, then, continue with it. But I think there's a lot of external pressure to be on social media, both, just personally, but also professionally. And I think that we just have to figure out what works for us and where we spend our time. And that's kind of how I live all the aspects of my life now.
Good life advice. And I think
Great.
that's a hard thing to see when you're first leaving training. And again, it's hard because I think when you leave, you got to judge based on your life situation, your energy levels, what you're interested in now may change in a few years. I think you're talking to three people here who are like between, 5 to 8 years out. And I think it's a different perspective when you've been out a little bit in terms of sort of picking and choosing what you do. But yeah, great article. Again, I suggest anyone who participates in social media, you should read it. It's a good one, even for your staff to clip out and put on your wall if you have staff you need to train. So anyway, thanks, Avni and Star Wars, for joining for this episode. Really appreciate your time and that you chose to give some of your time to do this. As Avni said, you all have limited time, so I appreciate this.
Thanks, Jay. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Jay, for having us.
Many thanks to Doctors Finn and Zahid for their time today. Listeners, remember you can find 447 episodes, now over 8 years, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. Big thanks to all of you who've listened since the beginning or picked us up along the way. It's your support that keeps us going. Again, this has always been a non-revenue generating labor of love by all the people involved, and that includes our great production team, Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, Mike Nakasa, all the physicians who come on, like Drs. Finn and Zahid. And we do it for you, the listener. We appreciate everything you do, all the patients you take care of, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. You can always interface with us and reach out with feedback or ideas for future episodes. Email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or click on the contact us link on our website. Till next week, this is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.